You're listening to the RedCafe.net podcast.
Coming up on the latest edition of the RedCafe.net podcast, we look back at what has been an eventful month for United, which started with the disastrous defeat to Manchester City. We also have an interview with the United We Stand editor Andy Mitten. Plus, we ask what the consequences could be if United finish second in the Champions League group.
Welcome to the RedCafe.net podcast. You can email us at podcast@redcafe.net, or alternatively, post your opinion on the RedCafe.net forums.
Well, hello and welcome to episode 88 of the RedCafe.net podcast. I'm joined by Dan and Dov. Guys, how are you this week?
Yeah, very well. But well this month, really.
I was going to say, I'm used to the old style of doing it every week.
I'm fine. Yeah, nothing exciting. But yeah, I'm all right.
Good stuff, Dov. You had a good month since we last spoke.
Yeah, everything's been all right. It's like Dan, nothing really much changes from month to month. So, although today, instead of having pizza, I bought a packet of these chocolates called Pocket Coffee. And they're like the Cure Coffee. It's like an espresso shot inside a chocolate, I don't know, cover. And you open it in your mouth and you just get coffee everywhere. It's great. But I've had a whole packet of them. So given the time, I'm going to be unable to sleep. So... not an eventful month, but an eventful last few hours.
Coffee, chocolate, I'll stay clear of them. I think that's not one for me.
Would you prefer? Would you prefer if it was tea? Like, imagine that, chocolate and then some tea. No.
Yeah, that might work. An invention voyaged off Dragon's Den.
See.
Right then, we'll kick off with United matters then, guys. And well, it's been an indifferent month. Is that fair to say? We left the last pod just before the City game, hoping we'd put in a decent performance and come away with a win. But obviously wasn't the case, and we'll get onto that later. But we'll start with the most recent game, which was, of course, Benfica, the 2-2 draw in the Champions League in midweek. Dan, putting it mildly, you weren't too impressed, were you? Especially with some of the defending.
No, I just think that when Vidic doesn't play, we seem to just lack a bit of leadership and discipline at the back. I did text you when Benfica scored the first goal. I do apologise. I didn't realise it was an own goal at first. But still, you know, the sloppiness, third minute of the game, to let Benfica in like that was poor, in my opinion. And then even though when we went 2-1 ahead, you know, within 2 minutes, it's back to 2-2 after another sloppy goal. I mean, De Gea should just put it in the stand, I think, really. I think he was trying to be a little bit too cocky with it, and he got caught out, and it's 2-2, and then, you know, we've got a really tough game in the final game of the group stage, you know, to actually qualify. So it's a bit worrying, really, especially as we've let in a lot of goals at home. I mean, we've let in 3 to Basel and 2 to the last opponents as well, so at Benfica, so it's a bit uncommon, really.
And any blame attached to Rio for the second goal? There's been a...
No, I don't think so. I saw that. I don't think so. I mean, Rio had to recover quickly. You know, he got in the way of the cross shot, didn't he? And, you know, I think he's done his best there. Aymar, to be fair, has followed it in like he should do. So I wouldn't attribute any blame to Rio there.
What about, sorry, Steve, I was just going to say, what about the general defending, though? Because, normally you would say that we're quite solid at the back, and like you say, it seems that when Vidic goes, we just fall apart. But you think when you've got Rio and Patrice Evra in your back line, I would say that should be enough to keep a clean sheet at home. And I can't understand why they seem to be unable to do it, really. And I was quite worried as well when Fergie said in the last couple of weeks about Rio losing a yard of pace. So it's like kind of half admitting actually it's not as good as he once was. And he needs to change his game up a wee bit, which is, I don't know, a tiny wee bit worrying as well, I thought.
I'm just surprised at the complacency, really, because, as Dan said, that's pretty much what it was. I mean, Jones, just put your foot through that and get it away. I know it's easy to say in hindsight what he should have done and what he shouldn't have done, but it can't come down to complacency, surely. They know they had to win that game, really, to put themselves in the driving seat in the group, and obviously now we haven't. It's come down to, well, if we lose against Basel, that's it. We're out of the Champions League. So I can't, like you said, I can't really understand why we didn't just go out and get the 3 points. But yeah.
I don't know, it seems strange to me. I don't think Fergie was kind of expecting to draw the home games that he's done against Basel and Benfica. I think he's expecting to win at least your 3 home games, and then anything you get away from home is a bonus, really. And I think that it's maybe just not caught him by surprise, really. And it's obviously that's kind of put us in a little bit of a sticky situation, but I still 100% expect us to go through the next round, because I still think that given the fact that we have to win, we will win, and hopefully we can win by a good few goals so we don't finish in second place as well.
And well, if we do finish in second, I think if Benfica beat Galati, which they're expected to do, I think that wins them the group. So if we were to finish second, is there any sort of fear factor about having to play the likes of Real Madrid, Barcelona, Bayern Munich, who have all been on top form so far?
I said off air, I'd rather play one of the big teams, because we seem to struggle against the little ones. And I also think if we were to, you know, get paired with Barcelona or Real Madrid in a two-legged game, I think we'd have a better chance of winning, really. And, you know, we shouldn't be afraid of teams. I know we're not playing well at the moment and we're scraping through games, but I think that, you know, big game atmosphere, if Real Madrid came to United with Ronaldo and all them lot, I think the fans would be right behind it, and I think they could give them a good game, even though I do think they're unbelievable at the moment. But I think, you know, you've got to be confident going into games like that.
I think, like, if you look at the teams that are going to win the groups, you've got, obviously mentioned, Real Madrid, Barcelona, Bayern Munich, Inter won their group. If Bayer Leverkusen get a decent result or win their last game, they'll win their group. If not, then it'll probably be Chelsea. And then you've got Apoel Tel Aviv or Zenit St. Petersburg from the other group. So basically you've got maybe 4 sort of kind of top-class European sides there, and then a couple other ones you'd expect United to be. But I think kind of like what Dan says, that it might be better to get one of the bigger sides, although I'd prefer Bayern or Inter, because I think we'd have more of a chance of beating them. I think the likes of Real Madrid, Barcelona, probably over two legs, well, would give them a good game, but I think they would probably beat us, to be honest. But I think we'd have more of a chance against, especially Barcelona. I think Barcelona over two legs would be a bit easier. But for me, like, Real Madrid are a higher level at the minute than Barcelona. But like I say, we're only speculating about what teams are like just now. I mean, it might be completely different come then. But we'll see. It's still difficult. Maybe a situation you'd rather not be in. But if you're going to win the competition, you need to beat other teams anyway, so why not beat them in the round of 16 instead of the semi-finals?
Yeah, there's always that. You've got to beat the best to win it, so yeah, why not get it out of the way early on? And when you do beat the best, you pretty much, well, you're up there with the favourites then, so yeah, if not already, of course. And just briefly, guys, we'll go back over the results since the last podcast. It's been, prior to the Benfica game, it had been 5 clean sheets since the City defeat, so that shows that things had been improving defensively until the other night. But yeah, don't like to go back and dwell on it too much, guys. But what were your thoughts on the City game without swearing?
I thought the first half was fairly close. Obviously, City got the goal, good goal as well. But we had a few chances in the first half to get a goal before half time, and obviously the sending off had an impact, but I could see us actually getting a goal during the game, 11 against 11. And I thought, you know, everyone was talking about how well David Silva played, but, you know, he didn't really do much apart from, you know, in the first half until Evans got sent off, and then he had a lot more space and he dominated, to be fair. And he was the difference between the two teams. But it's just one of them results, really, and it's just a freak result. I don't know why when City went 3 goals up, we didn't just say, right, let's just make sure we don't let in another goal. But we kept on going forward, and it's just, everyone's playing like left wing and all over the place defensively. And obviously the goals that came in the last 5 minutes, just, it was unbelievable. Me and Steve were watching it together. You had to start laughing at the end, like, what is going on here?
Yeah, but it just seems to be every attack, doesn't it? And
yeah, just every
attack. It was actually, what, 5 or 6 more chances they could have stuck away, really. So it was, in the end, 6-1 was probably, we got away scot-free, really. But
do you think that was maybe, because like, Fergie said the same thing, do you think that was like naivety on the part of some of the like the players? Because you had like obviously you've got De Gea, Smalling, like Anderson was in there, Ashley Young, well, he's not young, but he's a new player. Do you think that was naivety on their part? Where maybe if you had a couple of older heads in there, they would have thought, right, wait a minute, we're a man down, we need to pick the right opportunities.
Fergie's blaming the experienced players for that, but why didn't Fergie come down to the touchline and say, look, you know, let's not do anything daft, just have a quiet word with someone?
I think he was too angry then. He looked like a really angry man when that was going on.
Yeah, but, that, you know, he needs to come to the touchline a little bit more. He doesn't do it much anymore. He lets Mick Phelan do it, and I don't think people really care what he's got to say. And to be honest. But the fact is, I mean, I think, ironically, the Fletcher goal was a downfall, really, because I think once they scored that, they thought, all right, we can get another one here. And then, obviously, it didn't happen like that. Because I think Smalling actually had a header just after Fletcher scored. It could have been 3-2.
What about like Johnny Evans? Do you think that's him had it? Do you think that was just one mistake too many?
It was a mistake in the fact that he didn't know where Balotelli was. But I don't know how. I don't know how it happened. But because he was in front of Balotelli at first. You know, he was on control of the ball. And then sometimes he seemed to just stop. And then Balotelli went past him. And then obviously pulled him back. But it's just an unfortunate thing. Should have just let him go because Balotelli might have missed it.
Yeah, I don't think that'll be it in terms of Evans' United career. I think he'll get more chances. There'll be injuries and the like, and with Rio and Vidic, Rio probably more so coming to the end. There's going to be opportunities there in the next sort of 3 or 4 years. So I think he'll definitely still be around. But
do you think he's going to have it to step up, though? Because I think that Rio will be around, but I don't think he's going to be kind of seen as one of the players to kind of take up the mantle as the next first choice centre back. I think he's had his chances. It's been a year and a half, 2 years now where he's been making silly mistakes that he really shouldn't be making for a guy who we thought was going to could potentially get a first team spot in the future. But I just think every time he makes one of these mistakes, the chances keep going and going and going. And given it was against City and what happened after it, that it might be, I don't know, time to just say, right, Johnny, you're not going to get a number one, like a first choice spot anymore. The best you're going to be is a sub.
I think the thing with Ferguson, he loves his players to sort of come out and prove a point and prove people wrong. So if there is that general sort of perception that Evans is no longer able to cut it at the very top, I think that's all the more reason Ferguson will think to give him another chance to impress and another chance to show that he is still a top player. So no, I think he will still put faith in him if he has to. I don't think he's, like you say, I don't think he's first choice now, especially after what happened and with hopefully Rio and Vidic coming into fitness as we get towards Christmas and the sort of second half of the season. But yeah, we'll have to see on that one next time a big game sort of comes along against one of the so-called big four or five, whether he gives him the nod. But yeah, it'll be interesting. Right, well, we'll leave that there from talking about City and that game because I think it belongs in the past. Player and cabbage of the month then, guys. Dan, who'd be your standout player of the month?
Nemanja Vidic, all day long, has been brilliant. Just showing you by the records of the clean sheets the last few games how important he is.
Good stuff, Dov.
Player for me, I'm probably going to give it to Chicharito. Javi Hernandez, goal against Everton that won the game, and then the goal against Swansea as well that won the game, got the 3 points, so two vital goals. I was contemplating giving it to Wes Brown for the goal against Sunderland, but after all the 25th anniversary stuff, but I thought maybe a wee bit cheeky.
Funnily enough, I've got Chicharito down as well, so I'm just trying to take the easy way out there. I'm going to go for him as well for the reasons you've said there, two crucial match-winning goals. And cabbage then, Dolph, that were you this time?
John Evans, the aforementioned, for kind of contributing towards what was a quite horrendous result, one of the worst results I can remember being a United supporter, so he's getting that for me.
Dan?
I think Wayne Rooney. I think he's not been brilliant, probably since the City game, actually. He's not been brilliant, has he? I know he's been playing in midfield and dropping a bit deeper, but I think a player of his calibre should be stepping up a little bit more and helping us through this tricky patch.
Well, two good choices, isn't it? Well, I'm going to have to agree with Dan and give it to Rooney. He's not scored in a few games. Well, I don't know, can we give him the strike against Galati at home?
No. You might as well give it me if you're giving it Rooney. I was close to it in the stand.
But Rooney, going to hopefully be back in the side this weekend. And he needs to kick on, he needs to lead from the front, and he hasn't been.
The thing with Rooney is he does this often, though, doesn't he? He'll score a load of goals and then not score a load and then score a load again. It's like he needs to be more consistent. I've always had this argument with him. Not with him, but I mean like over him. I don't ring him up or anything, I'll tweet him.
Right, good stuff. We'll move on to reserves review now. I'm going to pass over to Dov, and he's going to bring us up to speed.
Thanks very much, Steve. That's right, it's reserves review time. There were four games for the reserves over the last month. The first came all the way back at the end of October on the 29th. It was a friendly against Altrincham. The game finished 2-2, but United had to come back from 2-0 down in the friendly. It was Jesse Lingard and Ravel Morrison got both the goals, and they'd just been added squad numbers on the Friday before, so it was a nice wee omen for both of them. And Jack Redshaw put Altrincham ahead 2-0 after the first half hour, but Lingard and Morrison both scored either side at half time to get a 2-2 draw for United. The second game came against Everton reserves, and this was on the 3rd of November, a magnificent 2-0 win for United. It was quite an entertaining game, and two finishes from Wilkie and Jesse Lingard were the difference. United came out the blocks of that game sort of quite fast and took the lead through Wilkie on the 6th minute. Some great control from him, and a rocket finished past Marcus Hanneman in the Everton goal. Then Jesse Lingard scored on the 82nd minute. There was some good work from Mamie Biranju beforehand. Threatened a couple of times, but it was Lingard, he sort of converted a cross from Sean McGinty, who came down the left hand side to make it 2-0, another magnificent win. The third game was against Wigan, and this was on the 17th of November at Moss Lane. It was a magnificent showing from United. This game was 4-1, 2 from Ravel Morrison, 1 from David Petrucci and 1 from Ezekiel Friars. Also in that game, Raphael and Darren Gibson played the full 90 minutes as they sort of began their comeback from injury. United were playing sort of full of confidence, knocking the ball around. And then on the 16th minute, Morrison just got the ball on the edge of the area, got it on his right foot, and then curled a magnificent finish past Lee Nichols in the Wigan goal. He then got his second of the game with another magnificent finish on the 54th minute. He got sort of hit it into the bottom corner instantly after Will Keane sort of played the ball inside for him. David Petrucci got the third 10 minutes later. Great finish after Nichols parried across from Jesse Lingard. Then Friars, he managed to get a glancing header in on the 79th minute. And then just before the end of the game, Wigan got their consolation goal. So, on to the final game. This was played on the 22nd of November. And this was a 2-0 win, or sorry, a 2-1 win, sorry, over Bolton at the county ground. Two goals from that man, Steve's favourite, Will Keane. He sort of made the biggest impact of the game. His first goal came after 15 minutes when the Bolton goalkeeper, Jay Lynch, sort of spilled the Jesse Lingard shot into his path and he just put it in. And then he got his second on the 62nd minute after some great interplay between Tom Thorpe and David Petrucci. And then Martin Petrov, he got what would be a consolation goal on the 71st minute for Bolton, but United well worth their winning that one. And obviously that was quite a good month for the reserves there. Jesse Lingard particularly impressed, along with some Ravel Morrison's goals as well. Some good performances from both of them. Right, let's move on to the Academy, who incidentally played Bolton Wanderers at the start of November and also won 2-1. It was a pretty forgettable first half in this one, but in the second half, the Academy side turned on the style and managed to get a 2-1 win over the Trotters. It goes from Charnay Kangameni and Jack Barnby got the points, but Bolton scored on the 88th minute to leave sort of the end of the match being a bit nervy. Kangameni strike came just before half time, a great long range effort fired into the bottom corner. And this was pretty much the only highlight of a rubbish first half. Then just after the break, the United side came out looking completely different, played fantastically well. And Giuliano Van Veldsen, he forced a great save from the bottom goalkeeper before Barnby. He got the goal in the 52nd minute after he took advantage of some sloppy defending from the bottom back line. The next game was against West Bromwich Albion. And we've got a new name for you, Norwegian midfielder Mats Deily, who scored two goals and another 2-1 win for United. In this game, this was United's third academy win on the trot, and Deily, he got the opener on the 12th minute after Jack Barnby got himself up from a foul quickly, got to a quick free kick. And slotted the ball through for the Norwegian. The Baggies then immediately came back into it, thanks to a penalty goal. Also a penalty that resulted in a goal from Jones. And it was quite a good match as well. Some great attacking football. And then Deily got his second of the goal in the 65th minute. Tyler Blackett's cross from the left wing found his way all the way to the far post, where the Norwegian volleyed it in from the underside of the bar. Magnificent from him as well. I've got a bit of a sad tale for you all. It was another 2-1 result this time for United, but it was against Liverpool on the 25th of November, and it was a 2-1 defeat, unfortunately, and it was a cruel defeat at that. And there were some blustery conditions at Carrington for the game, but there's one shaft of light. Sam Byrne, he scored his first academy goal for the club, but unfortunately we conceded after only 1 minute. First attack of the game, Jack Dunn ran through the defence basically to slip a finish past Liam Jacob in the United goal after 1 minute. But we showed some character and got back on into the game, back on level terms after 12 minutes, following a wonderful move from Van Velsen, Deily and Kangameni as well. And it was Kangameni who managed to get an assist for the Irishman to get his first goal for a club as well. But then this a late twist meant United lost the game when deep into injury time, we were left a shot at the back, and it was the man that scored the first goal, Jack Dunn. He got the second one in the 90th minute, which, was a league double for the Merseysiders against us, which is disgusting and horrible and not a very good way to end reserves review. But some good performances. The new man, Mats Deily, seems to be quite good as well. Van Veldsen playing well, and Charnay Kangameni as well, having some decent games too. One of the things I just want to finish on is Paul Pogba, because I've obviously been reading reports over the last kind of couple of months about how his contract's up at the end of the season, and there's been a lot linking him with our noisy neighbours, Manchester City. I mean, one, why do you think they've left it so late to even negotiate this contract? And two, do you think he will do a Carlos Tevez and move to the wrong side of Manchester?
I think he'll sign a contract at United. No doubt about that, really. I know a lot of the top clubs say they want him, but why would he not sign a contract at United? It depends whether, I suppose, if Ferguson's going to say to him, look, it'll be another few years before you get in the first team, then he might decide to go. But the way he's playing, he's not too far off, I don't think.
It just seems odd. It just seems odd to me that it's a guy that's kind of one of the most highly rated guys in the kind of the youth setup, and they've left it this late. And I think I'm sure I read somewhere that he was kind of wanting more assurances, like you said, and that he was going to get some chances in the first team.
So if you, I think he'll. We've got Crystal Palace next week. I think he'll. Think he'll start in that game.
The thing is, he's got to look at Ferguson's sort of record for bringing young players through, and it's sort of it's unrivaled really across Europe. The way he's sort of blooded youngsters and given them a chance, and if he goes to City, he ain't going to be anywhere near the first team, I wouldn't have thought, for a good few years. So, and if they continue to sort of improve, shall we say, then...
Maybe he's worried about the fact that, obviously, there's a lot of speculation around United's midfield now, isn't there? Obviously, people saying it's not good enough, we need this, we need that. And if Fergie's to give in to everyone, he'd go and buy a world-class player, wouldn't he? And that's what everybody wants, what seems to want. And then, again, Pogba then will be further down the pecking order, won't he?
Yeah.
But on the other hand, he's seen the progress that Cleverley's made.
All right, well, it's Dan's favourite part of the show. It's the Twitter roundup. And we'll kick off with Mr. Wayne Rooney. And he's been tweeting a lot about the X Factor, actually. He said it was the first time he's ever had to switch it off the other week. And he wants Simon Cowell back. So, yeah, good stuff.
See, Steve, I'm not being funny. That really, I mean...
I can't see X Factor, so that literally means nothing to me, but hey, what can you do?
Who's Simon?
he's also been tweeting to his teammate, David De Gea, and he says he looks 25 now, he's out of shape. another interesting one.
Hey, why are none of the United players doing Movember, by the way?
Maybe
probably saw your moustache, Dan, and just thought.
Hey, you, Steve, come on, mate, you love it.
Are you doing Movember, Dan? Really?
It's all. It's
the best tash you've ever seen. Pal, tell you what, it's unbelievable.
See, if you were Gary on Twitter, Dan, you could tweet the pictures, Dan. See, that's what you're missing.
I'm not tweeting anything, mate. I tell you, they're on my Facebook.
Gary Neville's was 10 times better. Let's just.
Sure, no way. You don't know that. No chance. That guy can't even grow one. And how old is he? So yeah, I'm proud of mine. It might not be the best. It might not suit me necessarily, but I'm proud of the fact that I can.
It's for a good cause, Dan. It's for a good cause.
Like, I've only raised £30, so I might as well just pull it out of my back pocket. I tell you. but yeah, it's £30 more than what I would get if I didn't do it, wouldn't it? Hey.
Exactly. Think positive.
That's it. Anyway, sorry, Steve, I interrupted. I apologise.
No worries. And another interesting one from Rooney for the 12 o'clock kickoff the other week. I think that was it the Everton game? He says 12 o'clock kickoffs are no good for players. Trying to force down pasta at 9 in the morning is not nice. My heart bleeds for you, Wayne. It really is.
So I hate it when I have to get up at 9 in the morning and eat pasta. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, can't believe.
And then look forward to playing for United.
And then checking my bank and realising that I could, my daily withdrawal limit's like $1 billion and not 300.
He needs to tuck himself up. Doesn't that, man?
Oh dear. Moving on to Rio, Mr. Twitter himself. He's been having a dig at Liverpool fans. He says they're the most bitter fans on Twitter. Fact. What's the problem, guys? Enjoy your team and don't worry about Man United 19.
That's good. I like Rio. That's nice. What a nice guy.
He's all about banter. And also on the racism issue, he sent a direct message to Sepp Blatter and he said, to say what you said about racism in football spoke volumes of your ignorance to the subject, which... obviously completely agree with, and I don't know what Blatter was on about really when he come out of what he said about saying handshakes should solve racism in football.
Yeah, I was interested. Blatter actually replied to one of Rio's tweets and saying the man you just called black had a name and this was his name. It was something along those lines, and I was like, really, Sepp, really? You're going to actually try and...
Did you see that photo of that him with that black guy on the...
That was the guy he was talking about. It was that guy, and he said, oh, you had a name. And I was like, this was his name. I was like, Jesus. Like, don't just say nothing, Sepp. It'll be better
Seriously,
for you.
Seriously, this racism talk, it's only really kicked off since... Was it Suarez and Evra? And then not a lot was really made of that. And then obviously the Terry and Ferdinand stuff as well. It just seems to be cropping up a little bit again, doesn't it?
Well, Suarez has been charged now, hasn't he? So
yeah.
Surprised they've taken so long over the Terry thing, really, though. I would have thought...
Yeah, he's never said it. You can clearly say what you can see what he said.
I think it's because of the police investigation, though. I think the FA are waiting to see what the police have to say, and then once the police have finished theirs, then...
What do they have to investigate, though? You can see it.
Racism against the law, Dan. So if he has been racist and it's been caught on camera, then it's criminal charges and not just a FA ban. So that That
well, how long does it take? Sure, it's in a book somewhere.
I don't know. Ask the police. I'm not a policeman. I'm just telling you what I know.
That's true.
Cool, right.
Well, to be fair, Steve, I mean, I'm not a big fan of this this roundup, and I'll make my feelings clear. But I've had a look at David De Gea, and I'm sad to report that I don't read much Spanish. Although he does like the Stone Roses, as he retweeted one of Rio's tweets, actually. I'm surprised you didn't have that in your tweet roundup. Which is a bit disappointing. I'm only joking. Anders Lindegaard, our number two goalie. Obviously, Fergie's 25 years in charge, and he tweeted afterwards saying he would just love to have a seat in the ground, never mind a statue and a stand named after him. And then some smart ass replied saying, "You've already got a seat, it's called the subs bench." which I thought was quite funny, to be fair. And our man, Anders, he actually lolled it. So, you know, respect to Mr. Lindegaard there. And he's also talking about how he likes to let milk just drain into his Oberon and see what happens.
What he does, he
gets over it. Well, it was only one tweet. I don't know if he does it regularly, but he had a bowl of Oberon, poured milk over it, left it for 5 minutes, and just to see what happened. I mean, obviously, it's going to go soggy. I don't know why else he expected, to be fair.
Sadly, setting fireworks off in his bathroom, though, is he?
No, I know. I've not got Balotelli on here. Is he on Twitter, Balotelli? He must be absolutely mad. Phil Jones seems to use Twitter a lot, actually, and he wasn't happy with the Jackson trial, which is quite an intelligent comment from a footballer.
What did he say?
He basically said, Steve, that he doesn't agree with the Jackson trial, and he said, you know, he's not saying that Murray is innocent, but he feels that they'll do anything just to reach a verdict and accuse someone, which I must say I kind of agree with the lad for that. That's my tweeting over.
There you go. I'll finish on... I've got three guys. We'll start off with Kiko Makeda. He just came back from the cinema and he went to watch Breaking Down. He can't wait for part two. I think he means Breaking Dawn. That'll be the Twilight film. So,
Break Down. What cars have you got?
Yeah, I was just like, it took me a wee bit to work out. I was like, Breaking Down. Is that a new film that came out? I was like, Breaking Dawn. I'm not too big on my Twilight film, so there you go. But he must have thought it was quite good, given that he's waiting for the next one. Then there was a reply to somebody with, "Why don't you shut your mouth, lad?" So how do we look to see what he'd replied to? And the message he got was, "He just finished training, my legs are gone, and now I'm having a good massage." So he tweeted that somebody else, we'll call him another smart arse, said, "Gone, so you can't play anymore, result." And then he tweeted, "Why don't you shut your mouth, lad?" So Kiko's not as playful as... Lindegaard is. And Dan, you'll be delighted to know that Kiko's had a pool tournament with the keepers. It was Mami Biram Diouf and Makeda against Kushak and Lindegaard, and they destroyed them. But he lost in the final against Mami. So there you go. He's been doing a couple of other things. He's been watching Italian Big Brother, and David Petrucci and Kiko Makeda made ravioli by themselves with their own hands in their house, and even tweeted a wee picture with them both holding one ravioli each. So he seemed quite proud of himself for that. See, this is the beauty to it. How would you know what Kiko Makeda was doing, that he could make ravioli by himself? There's not many people that I know that can do that. Next, we move on to Michael Owen. And Steve, you've complained about the amount of tweets he does, and it's ridiculous how many. Having to go through them all, the boy needs to get a hobby or something. He doesn't need to get a hobby, he needs to get a new hobby, because the one he's got, he doesn't stop talking about.
Loves his horses, doesn't he?
It's all horses. It's ridiculous. I've never met somebody who can tweet that much about horses in the Racing Post. He sent a tweet to Piers Morgan, and I think Piers Morgan must have said something about the amount of followers he had, and he says, "Oh, Piers Morgan, oh, I know. I lose sleep over how many followers I have. Well done for getting so many. You are my hero." I think he was being a bit sarcastic towards Mr. Morgan there. He must be watching, I don't know if this person's on it, but is it Celebrity Get Me Out of This Place or whatever it's called? I don't know. And he said, "Fatima, we all know you're an athlete. Stop telling everyone." And then he goes, "I can take phobias, as I'm petrified when it comes to heights. But come on, is there anything she's not frightened of? Why is she there?" So I don't know if you can fill me in on that, because that, again, apart from finding out Michael Lunsford is scared of heights, that means nothing to me as well.
No.
No.
Well, I've watched a few of them, and yeah, she just doesn't like doing stuff involving insects or like tiny spaces or anything. So he's very valid in saying what's the point of being there.
All right, there you go. Also, he's been watching some other sports on TV. When the best TV programs on TV are darts and dog racing, with his tweet, darts and dog racing on tonight, TV at its finest, and then darts is the best TV ever, so I'm happy there's a feast of it on Sky over the next few months. There you go. And a final one from him is doing his coaching badges, and he tweeted that he'd spent 5 hours one day doing his coursework for his coaching badges, and he'd nobody told him it was that hard. So there you go. Michael Owen is going to be a coach. And finally, I've got a nice one from that, or a nice two from Nanny. First one was after he scored, it was the goal for Portugal against Bosnia in the second game, and he said, happy to have scored such a great goal in a decisive game. But then this other tweet is great. I am at Miss World 2011 final. A good way to end the weekend.
It's a good way to end the roundup, to be honest.
You're listening to the redcafe.net podcast. You can email us at podcast@redcafe.net. Or alternatively, post your opinion on the redcafe.net forums.
Well, I'm delighted to welcome back on the pod, it's United We Stand editor and football writer Andy Mitten. Andy, it's a pleasure having you back on the show. Thanks for coming on.
A pleasure. Thanks for inviting me back on.
No worries. We'll start then by discussing your new book, United United, which is the third book in the series of in-depth interviews with former United players, this time it's focusing on the 1970s, and you've got the likes of Lou Macari, Sammy McElroy and Joe Jordan, just a few of the interviews that Andy got hold of. The book came out last month, and that's available in bookshops and online as well. Andy, what was the real highlight for you from the book? And in terms of like interviewing players, was there someone you were sort of particularly excited about meeting and interviewing to start with?
I always get asked to pick out the favourite person who I met, and I honestly say that I enjoyed all 11 for very different reasons, and they're all completely different personalities, and they've got very different life stories as well, and their lives have taken them far and wide. I went to Texas to meet Gordon Hill. He's been out there for about 8 or 9 years living near Dallas, and he put me up overnight with his wife Claire and told me all his madcap stories from when he played for Manchester United. And he is madcap Gordon, you know, he's lovely with it, but he's completely off his tree, and you can see why he was often a figure of fun among the other players. And then you go to more serious people like Joe Jordan. I went to see him in London because obviously he's still Tottenham Hotspur's assistant manager, and the first few minutes I felt that he didn't even want to be there. He didn't want to do the interview, and I was so close to saying, look, if you don't want to do it, just say no, but you've agreed to this interview and I've travelled down to London to see you. And there's plenty of other players who'd be up for this, and all the other players have said yes. If it's too much of trouble to you, don't do it. And as soon as he sat down and he'd found somewhere private, he sort of opened up and you could see him like a block of ice falling out. And by the end of it, he was, after he'd infused about Italy and his life, playing for Milan and Manchester United and Leeds, he's saying like, here's my number if you need anything, just give me a call and stuff. So it just shows how first impressions can sometimes deceive. The one thing with this book as opposed to the others was I got every single player who I requested. The only one I couldn't get hold of was Steve Coppell, and I spoke to him in the past. He's a great interview, but he seems to change his phone number every second Tuesday, and nobody had his number at all. Of course, when I put that in the intro and it came out, I've since had 4 or 5 people saying, hi, I'm Steve Coppell's brother-in-law. Why didn't you tell me, you know? How was I supposed to know that? But Jimmy Nicol, Lou Macari, Gerry Daly. Gerry Daly's vanished off the radar. No one knew where he was, and I tracked him down to a golf club near Derby, and his wife had just passed away, but I wasn't to know that. I went to see him, and he was really enlightening. Paddy Roach, who was got a reputation of being a hapless goalkeeper for mistakes he made. And you can see he's still scarred by that all these years later from events that happened in 1975. He'll go into a pub in Manchester and a few people will still recognise him, and he'll ask for a pint and he'll get served and someone will say, don't be dropping that now. You know, still taking the mickey out of him because of mistakes he made in goal for Manchester United. And other sides to players that I'd not seen before, Lou Macari talking about his 15-year-old boy taking his own life was just heartbreaking because Lou's got a reputation as being a joker and his life hasn't all been a joke. He's had some terrible, terrible times and for him to open up was fascinating. And then the lads who came over from Belfast, Sammy McElroy and Jimmy Nicol, I never knew, and I've known Sammy McElroy for 20 years, that he had to get his family out of Belfast during the Troubles and Manchester United had to pay to rehouse the family of McElroy and of Nicol because their families were getting leaned on by various groups over there because, you know, the sons were famous, they were playing for Manchester United and they didn't want to get entwined in the trouble, but it was very difficult for them not to because they grew up in areas where there was trouble most days. So I've not told you anything here about football. There's obviously a lot of football in there, but I tried to get a flavour of these players as people as well and put their lives into context and show that it isn't just about scoring the winning goal in the FA Cup semi-final against Liverpool, but what follows. And a lot of them have a real roller coaster of a life and there are as many lows as highs.
And I was just thinking there, actually, do you find that maybe players from the past are sort of more willing to open up to you a bit more? I know you suggested that Joe Jordan at the start wasn't maybe as open as you'd liked until you sort of got chatting to him a bit more and then he did eventually open up. But when you compare it maybe to the players of today, you've obviously interviewed some of the top names around at the moment. Do you find that they're maybe less open? I don't know whether that's because they've got agents and the like sat in on interviews and things like that. So
they're much better, the former players, because what they say isn't news. I mean, even someone like Cantona now was touting around to be interviewed in the summer and some of the biggest newspapers in Britain turned him down. They said, no, you know, you were yesterday's man. And I was really surprised when I heard that. And that was through his role with New York Cosmos. But all the guys I've mentioned from the 70s, what they say now, it doesn't make back page news. They're not contracted to a football club like they once were. So they can finally speak out and they can say, well, actually, I didn't like that person and I did like this person. I got on well with him. I really didn't like what he did. And the passage of time helps them put things into perspective and put their lives into perspective as well, because when they stop being footballers and leave football, they leave the bubble. They leave the adulation. They often leave the money, the fame side of it. Life becomes a little bit tougher for them. And I find that very interesting. And some of them can surprise. I mean, I was never going to interview Joe Jordan, but Gordon McQueen, who I did for the 80s book, insisted that I did and said, he will surprise you in the end. And he did do, you know, McQueen was right. McQueen's Jordan's best mate. But I felt that Jordan was, as you see with his public persona, that, you know, this guy who doesn't really say much, he's a hard, aggressive man, but he's actually a deep and thoughtful man. And the best example is probably with the 90s book, when I wasn't going to interview Andy Cole, just because of, I thought he's hard work. I thought it was hard work as a player. And I did him, he was my last choice, and I spoke to him, and he was absolutely brilliant. And he was probably better than any of the other players. And as a result of that, I work with Andy every week now. I do columns with him and other bits and bobs. And there's a side to him that I would never have said, this is what Andy Cole's really like. And a lot of people say, is Andy Cole not arrogant, not surly? And I say, no, he's not. He's actually very shy and he's very private. But once you know him and once he trusts you, and trust is the key word here, because none of them lads from the 70s would have said what they said if they didn't trust me. And because they're all, you know, they're searching pretty deep into their hearts and giving stories and talking about things that really mattered in their life. And if they didn't trust me, then there'd be no point me doing the book. They've got to trust you. And everything stems from that. And I say to them, look, I've got to do my job as a journalist, as a writer. I've got to ask you the difficult questions. I might not agree with what you say, but that's not the point. I've got to get the truth because my priority is to the reader. It's not to you. At the same time, I'm not walking into the distance never to be seen again. I'm not going to be stitching you up. And I hope that makes players a little bit more comfortable. And I think it does. I mean, Jimmy Greenough, when I first called him, he said, I've got nothing to say. And I said, well, Jimmy, that's my job. Well, go on then. Come and have a cuppa And 2 hours later, he's saying, it's just like a conversation, this, isn't it? And he was great. And Jimmy's then saying, oh, you've got to speak to him, or you've got to speak to him. So the first impression of Jimmy was, this is going to be terrible.
Yeah.
And he was probably the most enthusiastic person with the whole project in the end.
Brilliant. Well, just going back to the here and now, Andy, with United at present, what's been your sort of general assessment of how things have gone so far this season?
Great, great start to the season. I went on the pre-season in America and I thought that the players did really well. The performance in Washington against Barcelona was very good. And thankfully, Tom Cleverley carried on that form. Danny Welbeck's done well. I think David De Gea's done well, all things considered, apart from a couple of errors, which I wasn't surprised about. I think the start was surprisingly good. I mean, sat in Old Trafford as 8 goals were scored against Arsenal, I was thinking that this is incredible. You know, we've not signed any established players or the type of players that that some of the fans wanted. Yeah, Wesley Schneider being the perfect example, and I would have loved to have seen him come as well. And we're destroying teams. That mood has dissipated since, and after the 6-1, it's become a bit of a problem. And I think the hangover of that game still hasn't fully shifted. I know that we've won match after match, kept clean sheets, 1-0, 1-0, 1-0. I also did some research the other day and found out it's been our best league start to the season since 93-94, with 9 wins, 2 draws and a loss from the opening 12 matches. It just doesn't feel like that. And part of the reason for that is probably Manchester City and their form and the fact that they're winning every week. And if they carried on like this, which they won't do, but if they did, they'd be the first team to get more than 100 points in a 38-game league.
It's interesting, actually. I mean, last time we had you on the show, we asked you about City at the time, because I think that was just when they sort of started getting the money in and started bringing in some big-name players. And you sort of suggested that in Ferguson's era, you can't see them sort of ever overtaking him. What's your thoughts on that now? Do you think they're obviously more of a threat now considering the players they've signed in the summer, but are you maybe slightly more worried than you were in the past?
Yeah, I think that they've spent that much money that it's inevitable that success is going to come, and it did come when they won the first trophy in 35 years. In May, they've got a good manager, they've got a lot of good players, and it's frustrating as a United fan to see what is happening. Ferguson will see it as another challenge. He doesn't like what's going on there. He doesn't say so much in public, but in private. I think there's a lot of people at Manchester United feel that while City aren't cheating, that they've got an unfair advantage just because they've got a bottomless pit of money and they can lavish that on whichever players they want. Ironically, City have come into money at the same time as United's finances have become more strained because of the ownership.
Yeah.
And I think over £500 million has gone out the club in interest payments and payments towards the Glazers. And you can't help but think, imagine if we would have been able to spend that much money or some of that money, a fifth of that money on new players. And you can almost have a who's who of who you would have wanted. Then again, I'm not even sure Sir Alex Ferguson would have gone for players. I think that he genuinely is happy with who he's got. And a lot of fans will say, how can you be happy with the way the midfield is at the moment? And they're surprised when the manager turns around and says, I'm absolutely content and happy with the squad I've got. And there's nobody who's available who can improve the squad. And I think he believes that. And I think he's proved that many people wrong. You've got to give him the benefit of the doubt. The football the last few weeks has not been brilliant, but taken as an average from the start of the season, this has been a good season so far for Manchester United. There's been loads of positives and there's been a few negatives, the 6-1 being the main one. I think Tom Cleverley, I've been writing about him for a few years. I know Tom, he's a great lad. He's from a lovely family. His feet are firmly on the ground and I was really, really pleased when he had the start to the season that he's had. But he's been injured and he's not been the only one. And Manchester United have had a pretty formidable injury list so far this season. And that can derail any club. Remember United getting to Moscow in 2008 and not having a single injury. It was almost freakish that the team had got to the end of the season without having an injury. And it's not happening like that at the moment. So credit that United are staying in touch at the top. And if everybody does come back, if, and the team do start to play better and City do have a little bit of a wobble and City have still got to play a lot of the bigger teams, then we might be looking like we can win the league. I would say at this moment, Manchester City are favourites to win the league. And that's something I've never said in my life before. Yeah. But I think that realistically, the way they're playing, that they've got to be favourites. But I would still fancy Ferguson to overcome the challenge.
You mentioned Wesley Schneider earlier, and then you were talking then about how Sir Alex has, well, pretty much decided that he thinks he's got a midfield that's good enough to compete. But what's your personal opinion? Do you think we are lacking that creative central midfielder? And do you think that Ferguson will sort of eventually buy someone in that area? Maybe not in January, but possibly in the summer?
Yeah, I don't think anyone will come in January. And I think he's said as much. United were definitely in for Schneider in the summer and felt that he was too greedy with his wages and weren't going to be, not bullied, but put into a corner with his wage demands. And part of me respects Manchester United for not succumbing to those demands. Problem is someone like City can come in and just pay, but then they don't have to break even or come close to breaking even. And had Schneider come, would then Tom Cleverley have had the chances? You know, it's Sanchez, the Chilean player, Alexis. He was another one who United were really interested in. Had he come in, Cleverley wouldn't have had a chance there. And talking about this at the end of November, it doesn't look good. The glass is definitely half empty because of the injuries. But it could have been so different. And of course, I'd like to see some of the best world-class midfielders come to Old Trafford. But the manager seems genuinely happy. And as he said today, who would come? You know, Xavi's not going to go. Iniesta's not going to go. Xavi Alonso, who's a different type of player, even he's not going to go to Old Trafford. So it's looking at those emerging talents like he always has done. United are watching two or three players at the moment. And that's one thing I really like about the club's transfer policy. They pop up and say, OK, we've bought a Mexican kid called Javier Hernandez. And everyone goes, who? Mm. And he's a great signing. And Ferguson has done that throughout his time at Old Trafford. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, no one had heard of him outside of Norway. Ronnie Johnson. There's so many players who weren't on the radar, weren't the popular choice in the media, and turned out to be a big success. Whereas the big names who were being touted to come, David Ernst as a striker, Alan Shearer for a long time, and United were genuinely interested in those players. They didn't come, and it was their loss that they didn't come. So hopefully future players will see that.
You talked a bit about De Gea earlier in the interview, and also obviously new signings Phil Jones and Ashley Young. How do you think they've settled in since they arrived? Have you been surprised at all that they've done as well as they have, perhaps?
I think they've all done really, really well. Phil Jones, I remember watching him for Blackburn and speaking to the head of Blackburn's youth academy, Phil Cannon, and he was raving about him. And I just thought, yeah, this is like saying that he's a very good player for Blackburn Rovers. Nah, he can do this at a much higher level. A much, much bigger club. That was the feeling within Blackburn Rovers and how right they were. He's 19 years old. He's versatile. He's probably been the player of the season so far. He makes mistakes. His positional sense isn't that of Zidane at the moment and it's not going to be at his age. But what a signing. What foresight. Ashley Young, again, I think he's done well. He had a few niggling injuries which have upset his season a little bit. But overall, I think he'd be an 8 out of 10. He scored some really important goals. And then David De Gea, I knew he was good. I saw a lot of him for Atletico. And I thought...
Did that surprise you, Andy? Because obviously you've probably seen more Spanish football than we do. So when you watched him out in Spain, did you think this guy could be the next United number one? Or was that a bit of a surprise as well? Did you maybe expect someone a bit more experienced to come in?
I thought this is somebody who's going to be a world-class goalkeeper for a number of years. I didn't think this is a Manchester United goalkeeper. And that's only because Manchester United had never really gone for 20-year-olds. They'd always gone for more experienced goalkeepers. Although Sir Alex Ferguson said that he regretted not buying players earlier on in the career, Van der Sar being the main one. And I know that Eric Steele and Martin Ferguson watched it here 8, 9, 10 times. So they've scouted him properly. And people think that United just buy players on a whim sometimes. They don't. They really do scout players properly. And De Gea had done it at the highest level. He had played away at the Camp Nou and the Bernabeu. He was a Spanish under 21 international. He was getting rave reports of people right throughout Spanish football. And I spoke to people before he came, like Ricardo, the old United reserve goalkeeper who's back at Osasuna. And someone like him, you've got to respect his opinion. And when he says this guy's the best young goalkeeper in the world, you've got to listen to him, because this isn't a guy talking sat on a stool in a pub. This is a guy talking who's 38 years old and has played top flight football in Spain for all of his career, and has also had a couple of years in Manchester. The opinions are worth listening to. And I still think that David De Gea is an exceptionally good goalkeeper, but he's very young and he has and will continue to make mistakes. I just pray that he doesn't make big mistakes which end up costing Manchester United games, or, God forbid, you know, the semi-final, quarter-final of the European Cup, and he makes a howler. But I think he's the best young goalkeeper in the world at the moment, and I'd love to think that he'll play for Manchester United for 15 years. And I think that he's got the talent to do that, and the manager certainly rates him. I also think that Anders Lindegaard, it'd be unfair to talk about goalkeepers and not mention Lindegaard, because it's probably the best number two that United have had for a long time. Very confident young man, completely different in personality to De Gea. And in, those two are slugging it out for number one. And I think he will get a lot more games than a number two goalkeeper might otherwise expect. And that's perfect, again, for De Gea's development. It might not be a good thing to play him 50 times this year. Maybe play him 35, 40 times and let Lindegaard come in and play and do well. And he has done well. And I think that's a good combination for Manchester United's goalkeeping situation.
Okay, and briefly going back to last season and another Champions League final with Barcelona. Obviously, with you being close to Barcelona, do you think there's any lessons that we can learn from that game? And if we were to play them again this season, how would you go about stopping them this time around?
I haven't got a clue is the answer to that one, and I'm still gutted about it. I mean, I watch a lot of Barcelona and go back and forth between Barcelona and Manchester, and I was floored after Rome, and I didn't for 1 minute think that United deserved to win in Rome. But when it came to Wembley last year, I really thought United would learn the lessons and not get hammered again like they did in Rome. And I did a lot of media in Catalonia in the weeks leading up to the game, and I was saying, oh, we've learned our lessons. You're all cocksure. You think you can absolutely destroy us, and Messi's this and Messi's that. And it's just not true, because Manchester United are really good because of this and because of that. And I was so, so wrong. And I went into Wembley, sat there, and it almost mirrored the game in Rome, because United were absolutely fantastic for the first 9 minutes. I think Jason Park robbed the ball off Messi twice, and there was an intensity. I thought, we're going to win it, you know, it's all going to plan. But then I thought, no, it's impossible for any team to play like this for more than 10 or 20 minutes. And there was a crushing sense of inevitability, how Barca just sucked United out, and then bang, bang, the goals flew in and we got hammered again. If United played Barca again, I still think Barcelona would beat Manchester United 7 times out of 10. We'd probably win 2, and maybe there will be a draw. I just think that they are the best team in the world by a distance at the moment. And I don't like that I'm saying this, and I'm certainly not a fan of theirs, although I admire their football. But that's just how it is at the moment. They're exceptionally strong. Real Madrid are a very, very good team, and even they can't compete with Barcelona when they've met, although the Clásicos should be interesting this year. But you never know. We could draw Barcelona in the next round in Europe and get a fluky draw. And I think one thing that the Catalans would say is they really do respect Manchester United. When they talk, the players, about United, there's a genuine respect there. And it's not just platitudes saying, oh, we respect all opponents. You know, I'm spending a lot of time in Barcelona, and I hear what people say about Manchester United, and they're really, really respectful. However, they also know that they've got the best team in the world, but that will change. It's a cycle, and they're at the top of the cycle at the moment, but you know, Xavi isn't going to play forever. Puyol's not going to play forever. But I think this team will be remembered probably as arguably the best ever. I just dream of one day Manchester United having a team like this. But we've got to be happy with our lot. And I've seen United win 12 league titles and European Cup, the treble. I would never have imagined that when I was growing up watching Manchester United. And we've seen some world-class players too.
And this is probably a question you get asked quite a lot, I would have thought. The great man, Sir Alex, he continues to go on and on. But do you have any thoughts on who you think is in pole position at the moment to replace him? I know that is something that probably changes every week. But do you have any thoughts on that one?
It does change, you're right. And it's a question people have been asking for a decade now, ever since it was thought that Sir Alex would retire in 2002. And at that time, people were saying Sven-Goran Eriksson is the man to take over. And that wasn't a ridiculed and unpopular choice. You know, he was a serious contender at the time. And over the years, I've heard people mention from Brian Robson, Roy Keane had a time when he was doing well at Sunderland where he was seen as being a future successor. If you ask me today, I would say either Mourinho or Guardiola. Mourinho's not going to leave Madrid at the moment. And Guardiola's not going to leave Barcelona at the moment. But both of those clubs, the managerial fuse is very, very short. And they know that if they came to Old Trafford, they would get something they'd never get in Spain. And that's time and stability. And they get a lot of time to do the job properly. Because of the structure at the club at Manchester United, even though I don't agree with the Glazers, there is actually a stability that you wouldn't get in Spain because there's not the presidential elections and that type of stuff. Guardiola would be the man. He's intelligent. He's a great student of the game. He was a wonderful, wonderful player, totally underrated in the UK. And his track record is close to being faultless. Someone else has come onto the radar the last few months. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. He's had a brilliant first season in management in Norway, ably assisted by Mark Dempsey, a Mancunian, who he took from Old Trafford because he was one of the coaches at Carrington. And he'd never jump from Mulder to Manchester United. But if he get what's important now for Ole Gunnar is the next club he moves to is the right club and he does well there. And that could be a stepping stone. And you never know in 3 or 4 years' time, Solskjaer might have done exceptionally well at Aston Villa, for example. And he would be a very popular choice among Manchester United supporters. And why not? He knows the club inside out. Don't know anyone who's got anything bad to say about the lad. And I quite like the idea of him coming back. But in a year's time, he could have been sacked because he's gone to a club and it's all fallen apart for him. So who's to know? I think the thing is with Ferguson, he's just going to go on and on for as long as he can. And if that's another 5 years, that wouldn't surprise me either.
And just finally, Andy, last time you came on the show was 2 years ago now, which is amazing, really. It feels like it was just last week. But he talks about your younger brother, Sam, and that he was having a trial at United at the time and that he was doing really well with the Stockport youth team. So how's he getting on now?
Well, after that, he had a trial at United. He did really well. He scored a hat-trick. I had two United coaches ring me up and say, why haven't you told us about him? So United decided they wanted to take him and on a six-week trial, and Stockport County asked for £70,000 for him. He was 14 years old, a little ferret. He wasn't worth a fiver, let alone 70 grand. And I saw him play a few times at United. He scored the winner at Aston Villa away for the under-15s, and he did well. He didn't stand out. And I think at Manchester United, you've got to stand out. You've got to really stand out. And there's no shame in that. You know, he wore the shirt. He's a United fan. He still sells United. We stand outside the ground when he's not playing. But he went back to Stockport. Continued his development and got offered a contract. So he's now a full-time footballer on a two-year apprenticeship. He earns £81 a week. He thinks he's the richest man in the north of England. And he goes to Stockport County every day. Two problems. One, Stockport have been relegated twice, so they're now a non-league club. But that doesn't really affect their youth setup. And he's a centre-forward, Sam, and the striker the year ahead of him, he's on the fringes of the first team. And Tottenham Hotspur have just come in for him. So it shows if you're doing well at that level, teams come in for you. But the big problem for him was he ruptured his cruciate ligament in June. So he hasn't kicked a ball all season. So he did his ligament at the end of June. He started his two-year contract on the 1st of July. And he had his operation in August. So it's just been recuperation. He goes training every day. He does his weights. The operation's been a success. And he can't wait to be a footballer. He's broke his heart that he can't do the one thing that he loves doing. Yeah. So at the moment, he's getting paid 81 quid a week to pump weights in a gym. But I think that's, you know, it's made him mentally stronger. And it's made him realise that he shouldn't take anything for granted. And sometimes young players can be a little bit arrogant. So we wish him well. He needs a lot of luck. A lot of things need to go right for him. And there's another lad his age, Devante Cole, who's Andy's son. He's at Manchester City. And he says exactly the same thing to him. You've not made it. Statistically, the odds are still stacked against you. So just keep your head down, work hard and get lucky. You really need to get lucky and throw a bit of talent in. And hopefully they can make it. But unfortunately, statistics are against them. But let's see. He can play. Hopefully he won't get any more injuries and make a living as a footballer.
Yeah, I certainly wish him all the best and hopefully he's back playing soon. Well, thanks a lot for coming on the show, Andy. Obviously, the book United United for all our listeners. If you haven't seen that yet, make sure you try and get a hold of a copy of it. It's definitely well worth a read. I can vouch for that. And hopefully we'll have you back on the show again soon.
Thanks for your time. Really enjoyed it.
Okay, guys. Well, before we close the show for this month, we'll look ahead to some of the games coming up. Got Newcastle, obviously, on Saturday at home in the Premier League, and then it's the League Cup after that against Crystal Palace at home on the Wednesday. Then looking even further ahead, potentially tricky games. We've got QPR, Villa and Fulham away from home. That's all before Christmas, as well as what we discussed earlier, the crucial Champions League game in Basel. What's your thoughts on those guys, particularly the three away games I spoke of there? That could be a few tricky games.
I think the Newcastle game, obviously being the most prominent because it's tomorrow, I think it'll be another 1-0. I know we played fairly well going forward, attacking against Benfica, but I've just got a funny feeling we're just going to try and keep it tight again. But I expect us to win, and I hope we win. Because I've got a feeling City will slip up over the next few months somewhere, and we need to keep on their tail sort of thing. Crystal Palace could be a youthful team, but I'd expect again, to, especially at Old Trafford, to come away with a victory there. Away at Villa, we've got a decent record there. They're not playing very well at all. So again, you know, you'd look to pick up 3 points at Villa Park, but it won't be an easy game. QPR as well, going down to London, they beat Chelsea, didn't they? They've had a few good results down there, nearly got a result against City as well. They've got a few tricky games, really. And everyone says, you know, City's games are a bit harder this month, but when you actually look at our games, although you'd expect us to pick up maximum points in majority of them, they're all grounds that can be tricky, really. So it'll be interesting to see what happens, you know, on New Year's Day, up until New Year's Day.
Yeah, I think that all the fixtures that are really, like, eminently winnable, they're all pretty much all against teams in the lower half of the league. Like you say, most of them are away generally, but I think you would expect us to win all the games in the league and the Champions League game as well. And even the youth team or the protracted youth team against Crystal Palace. I think the game against Newcastle will be a bit trickier, given that they've got the joint best defence in the Premier League and we're not really firing on all cylinders at the moment. I think that'll probably be the hardest game we're going to have in the next month. Although you say the 1-0 win, then I'd be maybe a little bit of a draw, to be honest. I could see that happening as well.
Okay, well, that just about brings an end then to episode 88 of the RedCafe.net podcast. The email address is podcast@redcafe if you want to get in touch with any questions, comments, or just anything to do with the show. And we'll be back again next month.